Welcome to Job Tales, the podcast where you find heaps of interviews and explore your potential future favorite job. If you're thinking about academia, then listen to today's interview with Associate Professor of Marketing Caleb Warren. He devotes his research to what makes people cool, why people laugh, and the effects of humor in advertising. Today, he also tells us about the difference between a PhD and an MBA, which might be useful to know, and he gives his opinion on how AI and technology will affect PhD work in the future. Caleb, thanks for being here with me. I am very happy and proud to have you on board. Very excited also to be listening more about what you do. Can you, in a nutshell, a few seconds, describe your profession?
Sure. I am a marketing professor at the University of Arizona. And so my job involves three components. There's teaching. Most people are familiar with that, but that's really only 40% of what I do. I teach marketing classes. And the majority of what I do is related to research. And that involves, really, I get to choose my own questions, but the questions I work most on are what makes things funny and what makes things cool. The other 20% of my job is service to the university or the field in general. That involves things like running a PhD program, reviewing papers, editing for journals, that sort of thing.
Okay. Is it something you must do because you're a professor, or is it your choice?
The service component?
Yeah.
So you have to do some service. You get a little bit of choice over what type of service you do.
So 40% teaching, is that a calling of yours since you were a child?
I think when I was younger, I definitely wanted to be a teacher. That's of these components, maybe not my favorite part. I really enjoy teaching the PhD students because I'm teaching them how to become researchers and writers. Mm-hmm. I would say with teaching undergrads and to some extent master's students, like, I enjoy it okay, but it's not the favorite part of my job. So maybe it was more of a calling when I was younger than it is now.
And then research, I must say, I'm very impressed by your curriculum vitae. It's 10 pages long. And of course, there's a lot of your, you know, publishings and researches. And so, let's say, fil rouge of it is how you were saying humor and coolness. So what brought you that idea?
Yeah. So my field is marketing. My subfield is consumer psychology. And the questions that we ask in consumer psychology are, you know, why do people buy stuff? And then often, why does the stuff they buy usually not make them any happier? Or when does it make them happier? When doesn't it? And so focusing on the first question, when I was a graduate student, I was reading all about, you know, people buy things because they have a favorable attitude towards it, or they prefer it, or it maximizes their utility. And I didn't think like, oh, that's wrong. But what I thought was, that's not really why the people I know buy stuff. Like, you know, my friends, the reason they might buy a CD at the time, or, you know, a concert ticket, or $100 pair of jeans, or like go helicopter skiing or something, is not because they were maximizing their utility, at least not directly. They were doing these things because they thought they were cool. But nobody was really, very few people were researching how to be cool, or what is it that makes some products or brands or behaviors cool and others not. That became my dissertation topic, and I've continued with that research since. The humor research started almost accidentally a year or two afterwards. Both a professor at Colorado, Peter McGraw, and I sort of came at it independently, but at the same time through moral psychology. There is this literature showing that, you know, when people see something disgusting but is harmless, they'll often say it's wrong but don't have a good explanation. So a family that eats their dead pet dog, or a man who buys a chicken at the supermarket and has sex with it and then cooks it and eats it. And people are like, oh, that's gross, that's so wrong. And then you sort of press them on it. Well, why is it wrong? They can't give you an explanation. I think that research is great and all, but I was reading these papers and laughing. And I was like, well, why is this funny? And my colleague Pete was presenting research he was doing on taboo trade-offs with churches. So like when a church uses regular marketing tactics that people don't like they'll outsource prayer to India, or they'll raffle off a Hummer SUV to try to recruit new people into the congregation. And he's showing data saying like people think this is wrong, but then whenever he would present this, the audience would laugh. So we kind of got into humor by trying to figure out, well, why are moral violations or things that people say are wrong also funny? And that I think, bloomed into what we see as a larger humor theory. And many of the pages on the My Vita you referred to are filled with papers related to humor, either what causes it or what the effects are.
Have you figured out why do people laugh?
We have a theory of, so by humor, we mean why someone laughs or they're amused or they think something is funny. So these are sort of the three components. And our theory is, coming from this moral violation place, is that something is funny when we have these two different appraisals. One appraisal is that there's a violation or something seems wrong, but the other appraisal is I'm okay with it. It's benign. And this violation could be anything. It could be physical, like a physical threat. So if you look at where other animals laugh, it's usually in play fighting, like an ape is being chased and the one being chased laughs, or tickling, which is kind of like an attack that doesn't hurt and it's by someone you trust. But it also could be just a language violation. So most puns play on, we have rules for what words mean, how they're spelled, how they should be used in sentences. And puns will often play with that. So like a pun, you use a word to mean something that it doesn't normally mean, but there's another meaning that makes sense of it. Hmm. And so that would be the benign violation piece. And if either of these fails, then you don't get humor. So tickling isn't funny if you try to tickle yourself because there's no threat, there's no violation. Tickling also isn't funny if some like creepy dude on the street comes up to you and tries to tickle you, because then there's just a violation. It's not benign.
It's quite complex, I can see. I guess that's also why not everybody manages to make people laugh or an ad or a comedian or...
Yeah, and that's something that we sort of came to later throughout this process studying humor is... it's really difficult to become funnier yourself or to make other people funnier. And, there's a lot in the popular press and some in the management literature about, one way to improve the workplace is to just try to make everybody be funnier. And look, like, I would love it if there was just more humor in the workplace. People enjoy humor. Almost everyone loves to laugh. The problem is it's really difficult. Like we have a lot of studies where we've tried to make people be funnier, and it is tough. Most people can't do it. And there might be interventions than ways of designing it. And hopefully our theory might help a little with that, but it's still a long ways off. Like knowing that something's funny because it's a benign violation is very different than understanding, well, how do you create benign violations yourself?
Yeah. As I hear you talk, of course, I'm thinking, what could be the applications of such research? And of course, you've not done just one research. I mean, you've dedicated also your dissertation to it. So you've done a PhD on this, from what I could see also on your CV. Is there an interest? I mean, also commercially or from the industry, from the business side, for this? What could be the application?
So for humor or for coolness or both?
Both. Because actually, let's start with humor, because then I have a more generic question about coolness.
Okay. Well, with humor, there's sort of at least two business, I think there are many business applications. One place humor has been studied a lot in marketing is advertising. So advertisers will often use humor in their ads. And the benefit of that is people enjoy humor, and so they might actually pay attention to it. Whereas most of the time with ads, we try to tune them out.
Hmm.
But the effects of humor in advertising are not as simple as, oh, it helps. So one thing that my research has helped show, and there are other people doing work in this area too, so this is not all of my work, but really the collective knowledge, is that when you use humor in advertising, it will focus attention on the humor and away from everything else. So if you try to tell a joke and then say, oh, by the way, get my brand, that doesn't work so well unless the joke is about the brand. And even then, it can be a problem because, well, how do you create humor? You need to create these benign violations. Violations have this negative component. And so in order to make people laugh, there often needs to be something negative in the ad. And that can reflect poorly on the brand depending on how you create the humor. Mm-hmm. So one implication or series of implications of our research is that we can make finer recommendations for how to use humor in advertising, what type of humor to use in advertising, when to use it, and what types of effects it's likely to have. And a lot of what my research has shown is that you need to be very, very careful with using humor in advertising. It's not just like the more is better. And even if it's successful, and a lot of it isn't. So one problem with trying to be funny is a lot of times people don't think you're funny and that can backfire. But even when a brand is funny in an ad, it can attract attention to something other than the brand and distract from what the brand's trying to say, or it can cause consumers to think more negatively about the brand because the way you've created the humor is through this, you know, benign violation.
I see your career has been all about marketing. What was your initial interest in marketing?
Yeah, so maybe I'll give a little story about my progression from an undergraduate student to where I am now. So I was at a school called Emory in the United States, where at first they make you take courses in everything. And I kind of enjoyed all these different topics, especially ones related to social sciences. So I didn't know if I wanted to study history or philosophy or math or writing or economics. And I think my parents suggested business. Like, well, if you're not sure what you want to do, at least do something where there's a job after. So I did that. And then I took a marketing class and I was fascinated by it, largely because I was very afraid of what effects marketing might be having on both individuals and society. And then when I discovered that you could do a PhD in this area, and not only that, they would pay you to do a PhD in this area. It wasn't a degree that was going to cost more money, which especially in the United States is a rare thing. I knew that's what I wanted to do. So I went right from my undergraduate degree to, I took like a year to be a research assistant in between, but I pretty much went right from that to my PhD in marketing at the University of Colorado. So I was there for 5 years doing my PhD, where I was studying what makes things cool, what makes things funny, some of the topics we talked about. Mm-hmm. And then when you do a PhD in most fields, but definitely in business fields, after a certain number of years in business, it's usually 4, you apply for jobs as an assistant professor somewhere and anywhere in the world. And I was doing this just after the economy totally crashed in the late 2000s. And so there weren't that many jobs in the United States then. But fortunately, I got a job in Italy, I think because the Italians cared more than Americans about what makes things cool. And that was my research topic.
Okay.
So I was at Bocconi for 3 years, and then I moved to Texas A&M for 3 years, and I've been at the University of Arizona for the last 7 years.
Fantastic. And it's so from when you started your whole curriculum, you know, your whole career to now, did you know that's where you would end up doing?
So do you mean the job or the location?
No, the job.
The job. Yes. So when you start a PhD in, at least in most business fields, they want you to become a research-oriented professor at the end. That's the goal of the program. Because in business, if you're planning to work, you would get an MBA or maybe a master's degree. Those are more designed to teach people how to, those degrees are designed to teach people how to do business. Whereas a PhD is designed to teach people how to research questions that are of interest to business. So, you know, from the time I started my PhD, I was very much on track to become a marketing professor.
Okay. That said, why coolness for you?
It was because when I looked around, I was trying to figure out why people buy stuff or why people do the things they do. And my biggest interest is probably music. I play in a band and I've been like just a huge music nerd since I was in high school. And when I looked at like, why do people like music? It really seemed like, yeah, it has something to do with the sound, but it has a lot to do with how cool some artist or song or band seems. And I mean, that's true of many different industries too. Fashion, technology, a lot of why some brands sell better than others is because they're seen as more cool. And this seemed like an interesting cultural phenomenon that just hadn't been studied very much. So I thought it would be fun and interesting to try to figure out, well, what is it that makes people, what is it that makes brands, what is it that makes behaviors seem cool?
Seem cool. In one of your peer-reviewed publications, you talk about is being a emotionally inexpressive cool? So that caught my attention. What was your conclusion?
Yeah, just a little background on why we asked that question. When I first started researching coolness, there was mostly books written about it or articles without a lot of data. And what many of them were saying is the way to become cool is by not showing your emotions, by being inexpressive, by, you know, controlling or concealing what you're feeling. And that struck me as not really what made the people I know who I thought were cool, cool, because many of them were very expressive. So I thought, you know, we can test this. And what we did is we took a number of different advertisements and we'd either have the models in the ads smile or be inexpressive. So just sort of showing no emotion at all. And what we found in almost every study, there are a couple of rare exceptions, but the people seemed cooler when they were smiling, when they were showing emotion, rather than when they were inexpressive. So even James Dean, who many people had written, James
Dean
became
cool. That's the guy I'm thinking about.
Yeah, James Dean became cool by not showing his emotions. Well, in our study, we have a picture of James Dean smiling and a picture of him, you know, with his sort of straight face. And people think he's cooler when he's smiling.
Okay. And did you find a definition for cool?
I was, yes, with a caveat. The sort of the way I was able to study cool, I had struggled for a couple of years, was when I realized that you can't have you can't have scholars, you can't have people like me imposing a definition on cool, because the only thing that people agree about coolness is it's in the eye of the beholder. So what I've always done is try to figure out, well, what is it that causes other people to judge something or someone as being more or less cool? And so I've defined it in some ways operationally, meaning I'll measure, you know, how cool do you think this is? Or, you know, this person's cool and this is not. This person's not cool. Tell me how they're different. So I've always looked at the way people actually see things as cool or not. And then from that, I've backed into a definition where I've defined, I will call it a working definition, because if the data come in that show that people see something as cool for a different reason, we need to update it. But my view of coolness is it's a socially constructed trait that people perceive in objects or other people that they see as autonomous in an appropriate way. So the two key features there are autonomous,
okay.
Like they go their own way, they're independent, they're creative, but in a way that also seems like it's fitting or it makes sense or it moves society or something forward, it looks good. The appropriate piece is what distinguishes, you know, someone who's cool from someone who's just crazy or wild or even in some ways funny, because it's not that they look worse when they're doing something unusual that's cool. It's different and better usually.
Interesting. And so because as you have seen also in previous interviews, I have interviewed people that work around marketing, either marketing manager or studying about marketing. Or there was also Aline from the Nariely who studied behavioral science. In your case, it's a career, academic career as a professor of marketing. Is there space for more, let's say, young students and then future PhDs in this field? Is this something that you could recommend for young people?
Absolutely. Yeah, and we're most years we're trying to recruit people into our PhD program, which is designed to train them to do exactly what my job is and the job of other marketing professors. And to be a qualified candidate for that, you need at least an undergrad degree, and oftentimes a graduate degree will help. And it helps to have some training in at least a little bit of math or social sciences. But really, like, what we need are people who are willing to work hard and are super independent and motivated. Basically, I think the biggest trait to succeed in the job I have is you have to work when you don't have to work.
Okay.
Because all the deadlines are so far off. So with many jobs, you have like a list of things you need to do during a day or during a week. And if I were to start a project today, it wouldn't be published within 3 years.
So you have to, I see what you mean by motivation. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's no like deadline for me submitting that. And so it's very, it's difficult for a lot of people when you have to either create those deadlines yourself or just be able to, you know, again, work when you don't have to.
So the main traits you would say, like rather soft skills, I would say, are really the determination and the motivation and being independent and being able to self, you know, pace yourself, basically.
Yes. And then I would say more objectives. The yeah. technical skills that are helpful. So there's different types of research to do within marketing. So about half the field is really quantitative focused and you need to be super good at math and statistics for that side.
Hmm.
For the side I do, which is more psychology, I would say creativity is more valuable. And I would say writing's helpful regardless, but I would say writing and creativity are more helpful. We do need to have some statistics and quant skills, but they're not the level that I need for my work is something that I think most fairly intelligent people can acquire. You don't need to be gifted at math.
Do you see a future, a change, let's say, in the future of your profession, or maybe the study, the content of the studies, and now with the you know advancement of also AI, virtual reality, and the new technologies?
Yes. So I'll answer one question about AI first, and then I'll answer, I think, one about the broader changes in the field. Okay. For AI, I think it's hard to know exactly how that's going to change things. I've been working on a project with a few co-authors trying to see, you know, can we get AI to help scholars write more clearly? One of the biggest complaints I have of academics is a lot of them are not very good at writing. And there's a writing style that makes it super difficult to understand for anyone who's not in that specific area, and even can be difficult for people in that area. So, you know, can AI help write more clearly, help scholars write more clearly? I hope so.
Okay.
That's one, I would say, smaller problem or a smaller change in a way. The bigger change that's been happening for the last 10 years is there's a push towards making the data we gather and the papers we publish more reliable. And there is a lot of sort of cute studies that haven't replicated. So, you know, someone will solve word puzzles about old people and then supposedly they'll walk slower to the elevator afterwards. So there were a lot of studies like this that were going on, you know, 10, 20 years ago. And since then, there's been kind of a reckoning where this phenomenon called p-hacking's come out. There's fraud that's been exposed. And there's been a lot of attempts to replicate studies. So rerun an experiment and show similar results that have failed. They didn't show similar results. So I think I'm hoping that the field is moving more towards reliable and robust results. So in effects that maybe are less surprising or less cute, but that will replicate and that, you know, so policymakers or firms or consumers can use them because, you know that if you make this change that's in the study, it's actually going to have an effect. It's not just sort of a freak thing that ended up happening once and got published because it seemed exciting.
Yeah. I see. Is there any final suggestions or advice that you would have for a young crowd that's listening to us today?
I think there's always this sort of advice to follow your passion. And I think that's often hard to follow because you need to pay attention also to what, you know, you're good at and the market values. But one nice thing about if you are able to get into a research position in academia is you do have a lot more flexibility to study what you want. I mean, you can't do anything you want, but you, at least in terms of the research questions you choose, you can pick the questions that interest you. And assuming you can interest others in them as well, there is a little bit of selling that, I mean, like I get to spend most of my days thinking and writing about two questions that have fascinated me probably since I was a kid, but definitely more focused in the last 15 years. What makes things funny? What makes things cool? And I'm very grateful for that. And I think that academia and academic research is one area where you do get a lot of you get more of an ability to think about and write about and study and focus on the ideas that you are passionate about.
Know your passion before you follow it. This is my take on today's interview. Thank you, Caleb. Keep listening to my podcast. You'll find me on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Just type Job Tales, T-A-L-E-S. Bye for now.